Geekville Radio.
Welcome once again, fellow geeks and geekettes. This is Seth, a.k.a. Xandrax, the mayor of Geekville, and the host of Geekville Radio. We got a jam-packed show for you. We've been working at this show for a while now. We've got a big subject to talk about. Captain Marvel has probably already hit movie theaters by the time you hear this. And I am prefacing this show by saying this is kind of anything you need to know about Captain Marvel, because there's a lot that's not known about Captain Marvel. And fortunately, I don't have to do it alone. I do have my usual co-host in crime, Crazy Train Jonathan Bullock.
All aboard, ladies and gentlemen.
And we have a special guest. He's been on the show a few times before, and he's actually going to be with us through the duration of this show. We're going to have another review at the end of this, also kind of curtailing on the Captain Marvel talk. We're going to talk Alita Battle Angel, but he will stick with us for the Captain Marvel talk, and that is Leadbase, a.k.a. Nick.
Hey, what's going on, Xandrax? What's going on, Crazy Train? How you doing?
Good. I want to personally thank you for coming on. I always love when you're on, Nick, because we can actually say, look, see, it isn't just fans. We have real comic book artists on here every once in a while, too.
That's right. I am a comic book artist, and actually coming up at C2E2, I will be doing a signing at the Heroes Initiative booth. So that's coming up this year in 2019.
Excellent. It's kind of like, you know, I always balance our wrestling podcasts over. Seth's a lifelong fan. I'm a guy who actually made a living in the pro wrestling world. We never able to say that in our geek podcast, but we can when we have you on. So thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Now, a lot of people have noticed, and the comic book fans have definitely noticed, that within approximately 1 month of each other, Marvel is going to have their Captain Marvel movie, and the DC movie universe is also going to have their Shazam movie. And I want to take a few minutes to get people up to speed on kind of the history of this, and we'll also talk about the Captain Marvel and the Carol Danvers character, because as we've said before, both off and on mic, that, you know, Carol is not a newcomer to the Marvel Universe. This is no new thing of this being a female superhero front and center, but we'll get to that talk in a minute. I did want to talk about, as I like to call it, Captain Marvel. No, the other Captain Marvel, because, you know, back in 1939, there was a company called Fawcett Comics. Fawcett spelled like the late great Farrah Fawcett, but they created a character called Captain Marvel. And this character had superpowers, flight, super speed, super strength, and all that jazz, wore a cape, and DC Comics sued Fawcett. And feel free to jump in, guys, if I'm getting something wrong here. But
no, this is actually my history lesson.
You're doing so good so far. The only caveat I would add is our listeners know I'm a huge cape fan. This Captain Marvel that Xandrax is talking about, top three capes of all time. But that's why I like him. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
But anyway, DC Comics sued Fawcett because they saw this Captain Marvel as an infringement on Superman, because, you know, superheroes were a very new thing back then. So having a character with the nice slick black hair and the cape and the flying and all that, I can kind of see why somebody might try to, you know, copyright that type of look and that type of character, because, you know, it just wasn't as big of a genre at the time. But anyway, the legal proceedings lasted years, but the courts eventually sided with Fawcett Comics, stating that DC did not properly maintain their copyright claims. So the Captain Marvel comics were produced for, I want to say, about 15 years or so. I think it was around the 50s when that was finally settled, maybe the late 40s. But long story short, Fawcett basically got tired of legal proceedings and stopped publishing Captain Marvel titles and basically got out of the comic business. Well, that may seem like a simple ending to the story, but it gets better. Eventually, DC bought out Fawcett Comics properties, meaning they gained control of all of the Fawcett characters. And this, of course, included Billy Batson, a.k.a. Captain Marvel. And around this time, another company called MF Enterprises started publishing their own Captain Marvel. And unlike Fawcett, this Captain Marvel was an android who looked nothing like a superhero. It was one of those things that really didn't get very popular and was canned after a few issues. But I only mention that because it's like a, no, Captain Marvel, no, the other, no, the other, other Captain Marvel, you know.
and you might want to add for historical reference, if you go back to the original Fawcett Comics Captain Marvel in the late 30s, early 40s, there was one calendar year, I want to say it was 1942, but I could be wrong. If I am, please, listeners, correct us in the comments. He actually was the number one selling title in all of comics. He outsold Superman and Batman.
I believe
that's how
you're right.
popular he was at his, you know, at his birth, so to speak. So this is like he was a small player, you know, is what I got,
right.
I'm trying to say.
Right. And especially when you factor in that the whole gimmick with Captain Marvel is Billy Batson says the word Shazam and he becomes a superhero. I mean, that gimmick is still around to this day. So
yeah, and yeah. other than the costume, you're right. The look and the power set is eerily similar to Superman. So you can see where DC would say, you know, they probably didn't care until a few years into his run and like, oh crap, he's beating Superman in sales. We have a problem.
And back to your point too about the legal side, when you said the reason why the court sided with Fawcett was because DC didn't defend their copyrights enough. I'm assuming what that meant was even the courts probably proved, well, here's this guy in a red suit that can fly and you didn't sue them. Here's this guy with a cape and super strength and you didn't sue them. And that's the unfortunate side of what it means to actually maintain your own license rights too. You have to actually go after all of it. Otherwise, when a sincere case like that would stand up, the courts will just throw it out. Like, well, you didn't do it evenly across the board, so it doesn't stand.
Right.
That's unfortunate. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure the judge that sat on this case, or judges, probably plural, because it ran for so long, and I'm sure Seth is getting ready to get into this. If you want to break it down from a comics point of view, Superman, who was kind of their, you know, DC's, that was the what they held up with going, you can't have this because we have this guy, right? They're the same character. We know as geeks, Superman gets his powers through being an alien, whereas Shazam slash Captain Marvel gets his powers how, Seth? I'm sure you're getting ready to get to this point.
Magic.
Exactly. So their origins are different, which I don't know in 1950, if you're a lawyer, you're going to argue that. But if that was the argument that they put forth in court, it's a valid one, in my opinion. But I'm not a judge or a lawyer, so what do I know?
Right. I could definitely see a stronger case by DC if Captain Marvel was also an alien.
Right. Mm. Right.
I'm digging on this MF Enterprise, though. I'm digging on their version of Captain Marvel. He apparently just shouts split and hits people with all his limbs. I want to draw that in a comic now.
the robot Captain Marvel? Yeah.
Yeah, he's split! And then his limbs and even his head, they all just go jettisoning off of his body into the villains. Okay, I want to see that in a book now. Change the color. Let's get the rights back. I want to make that a book.
I might also want to mention, years later when DC invented Cyborg, now granted Fawcett didn't exist anymore, I wonder if they could have sued themselves for recreating the same character with, anyway, I'm sorry.
DC gets all ready to produce stories about the Captain Marvel that they now own, except there's one problem. Marvel Comics has come along, and they actually now registered a copyright on the term Captain Marvel. So that's right, the name Captain Marvel hadn't actually been put through the proper copyright procedures, and so that left another legal battle. And we don't really need to go into the length that that went over, because the long and the short of it is, this is the part of the story that many comic fans know, which is DC's Captain Marvel, since the name Shazam was used so much, eventually just got published and promoted as Shazam, as long as Marvel Comics kept producing comics with a Captain Marvel in it. Going back to that talk about enforcing your copyrights. You know, you can't just grab a copyright, not do anything with it, and expect to keep it. I think that's really what the legal argument was. So that's kind of where we get the differences between why there are two characters named Captain Marvel in two different companies. I mean, did I miss anything?
No, not that I can.
I mean, I do know, and I might be jumping forward ahead of you, Seth, there was a time when DC went back to calling him Captain Marvel, but now he's back to being Shazam. And I think for our generation, he'll always be Shazam because of that wonderfully campy live action Saturday morning show from the 70s. where even in print they were calling him Captain Marvel still, but the show was calling him Shazam. And I think that that's probably, and they are again today, and that's why the movie coming out is with Zach Levi is called Shazam as well. That pretty much became the name of their Captain Marvel for whatever reason. You know, you can talk, was it legal? Was it an editorial decision? It just is what it is, you know?
Right. So that brings us to Marvel's Captain Marvel that we are going to see introduced in the latest MCU blockbuster. And we'll talk about that to get people up to speed on the character, and then we'll dive into the meat of the conversation, which is going to be, you know, all the controversy we're hearing all over the place. But first and foremost, Captain Marvel is closely associated with the alien race of the Kree, and fans that have been watching the ABC series, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., have kind of seen the real background of the story kind of developing with the Kree, because the whole last season took place in outer space. So Captain Marvel has always been more of a cosmic-based character and not Earth-based. Now, the Captain Marvel that we're going to see, Carol Danvers, she's like at least like the seventh Captain Marvel to come along. You know, the first one in the 1960s was actually called Mar-Vell. It was M-A-R-V-E-L-L. That's the only Captain Marvel that Stan Lee actually has his name attached to. He and Jean... I don't know if it's pronounced Colin or Colan or whatever. It created, Colin. Yeah, that character. There was also, in the late 70s, early 80s, Monica Rambeau, who I believe has a cameo in the movie. She was the second Captain Marvel, and worth mentioning, a woman of African-American descent. So, you know, Carol is not even the first female Captain Marvel to come along. There was Genesvell, the son of Mar-Vell in the 90s, Phyla-Vell, who was Genesis's sister, and one I want to mention here, I can never pronounce the name right. It's like Kinnear or something like that. Not Greg Kinnear, of course, but it's K-H-N-apostrophe-N-R. And that was a character who posed as the original Mar-Vell during the Secret Invasion storyline because, in actuality, he was a Skrull. And obviously, we know Skrulls are going to be heavily featured in this movie. The Kree-Skrull War goes back God knows how long.
Centuries.
And, yeah. And my hunch is this is going to be what Jude Law is going to be attached to. Like, the Jude Law that we see might not be the actual Yon Rogg character. Now, Yon Rogg, if I know my classic Captain Marvel, is more of an adversary to Captain Marvel. But, you know, I think they might weave those in. And the last one before Carol was Novar. And he was the one that was part of the Dark Avengers. And it's not until around like 2010, 2012, I think, when Carol finally picked up the mantle of Captain Marvel. So did I miss anything with all the Captain Marvels there?
Not that I can tell.
Nope.
It was a hereditary line, like you said, passed through family because they were this Kree race. I mean, are you going to talk at all about what the Kree and the Skrull are, at least at a very basic level?
I think we can do that, yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of talking here. So gentlemen, if one of you want to steer the ship for a bit.
Oh, well, I mean, I'll talk about it a little bit. The Kree-Skrull are, like we said, two cosmic entities who have been at war with one another for literally centuries, millennia. And it begins to bleed over into our world here on Earth because the Kree are usually painted as the good guys. The Skrulls are painted as the bad guys. That's, I guess, up for interpretation. I do feel that the Skrull probably are a little more chaotic or evil, you know, whichever you want to call it, than the Kree are. The Kree look more human. They tend to have blue skin, pure Kree do. But what you're talking about with S.H.I.E.L.D. is in the comics, the Kree, in an attempt to fight the Skrull, have gone to many planets and tried to create scientific experiments where they have hybrids of whatever that planet's sentient beings are with themselves, and that is where the Inhumans in the Marvel world come from. Of course, that was a disaster for the MCU, and they kind of want you to forget that happened, but that's what that whole storyline was about. And Quake, on S.H.I.E.L.D. is one of those experiments. She is derived from one of those experiments. The Kree have all the kind of power set you would think of almost like Superman, you know, flight, super strength, invulnerability, They can create create small wormholes and travel through space time. The Skrulls' big power set, they tend to look like they're green skinned. They have pointy ears. Think of your traditional Dungeons and Dragons goblin look is kind of what the Skrull look like.
Right. And they've almost got that ridged Thanos chin.
Exactly. Good point, Nick. And their major power set is their shapeshifters. And they also are super strong, highly invulnerable. That has been a tool that writers have used to incorporate the Skrull into storylines. They often pose for years as something that they're not. And then their true identity comes out and their true motives come out. With the ability to shapeshift, the Skrull are often presented as very, you know, cloak and dagger espionage in their approach to how to fight, you know, tactics for this war. And these two races haven't just fought each other. It has bled over into other major Marvel titles, especially the Fantastic Four, but other titles as well. And it makes sense, I guess, that the Fantastic Four would be one of the major titles, as they were always presented as the heroes in the Marvel Universe that protected the Earth from cosmic threats. You know, so
yeah. And to preface a lot of this going into the movie, obviously the movie has already hinted towards it in the trailers. They've mentioned the Kree. I believe they've mentioned the Skrulls. So
they have.
If you look closely, you will see them in the trailer.
Okay. Yeah. When it came to one of the bigger story arcs when they did Secret Invasion, and they covered Marvel Comics with Skrulls for years, it drove me away. And I think I may have actually pointed that out on one of my past podcasts. It drove me away from reading Marvel Comics at the time. And it's not even because I read into it and didn't like the story. Sometimes when it comes to fans, no matter what you're into, there are just certain stories that just don't appeal to certain kinds of people. And I'm one of those kind of people. I really don't like the sort of spy among us, the sort of the mole among the crew. That type of story of like, uh-oh, there might be a villain among us, that, you know, which one of us is the bad guy.
Right.
Barring John Carpenter's Thing, barring that from that list.
I was getting ready to go to that analogy. You know, I'm a John Carpenter freak. So,
because dang, if they didn't do that really, really well. I love that movie. So barring that from the list, it normally doesn't sit well with me just having to read it out, just watching one person, you know, confront the other person or fear and doubt each other and watch it to kind of separate. To me, it's just not entertaining to see it happen. And maybe that's coming from my sort of family environment with my extended family. Maybe that's what kind of made me that sort of reader. So knowing that going into this movie, I'm not even counting that as a negative mark towards the movie. I'm not at all. Like, I'm willing to go into it completely and say, the same way I would if I pick up a book for the first time, impress me. And that's what I'm waiting to see. So knowing that that's going to be a major player in this story, it has my anticipation. I'm forcing myself into a position of kind of going, okay, let's see how they do that really well. As again, using John Carpenter's The Thing, using that as a basis, it could be a really interesting story.
You must have really hated the mid-90s in movies, because I think it started with the first Mission Impossible. That became the trope of like all action movies for about five years. The mole. But that was probably the first one to kick it off, but I digress.
Yeah. And what borders on that is a lot of Jeff Loeb writing of the whodunit. You know, the whodunit type of story is really close, but at least the whodunit is still being honest about who they are. You just don't have enough clues to confirm it. But when it comes down to, we got clues, we definitely know it's somebody, but that somebody could be anybody. And then it's just sort of like, well, then obviously that breaks the reality from me. And I'm too busy looking at it as though it's a writer who's just not giving us that detail yet. And then I see that too much and I separate from the reality.
I blame the movie version of Carrie with that wonderful twist ending at the end. I think fast forward 15 years, all these writers that were now writing in Hollywood and comic books were so moved because it was such a big, you know, cultural icon for that time. Oh, wow. We got to give them the twist. We got to give them the twist.
Where's the twist?
Yeah. I mean, the guys, Sean Cunningham has openly admitted, and Victor Miller, when they did the first Friday the 13th, they had not written into it, you know, the young Jason popping out of the lake. It was simply the studio going, well, you know, Carrie was a really successful horror movie and I had that. So give me a twist ending too. And
it became such a trope.
We all know in entertainment industry, if something works, they're going to beat it to death, right?
Yep. And Tom McFarlane predicted that with his movie Spawn. He said back in the 90s, he said, if this movie gets popular, he's like, I know exactly how Hollywood's going to work. They're saying, no, we can't do it. We can't do it. It's too risky. No one's done anything like this before. We can't do it. But the moment we do it, if it's successful at all, I guarantee you, they're like, oh, it succeeded? Okay, give me dark, give me hell, give me swearing, give me, you know, and we need superheroes. A lot of superheroes who are dark.
Giant mechanical spider.
And we could talk about DCEU versus MCU right now being an example of that, or the dark universe, and, or, you know, the dark universal. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. We're seeing it right now.
And it creates that cultural trope where cultures tend to expect it, that actually, if you look at the ending of the comic book Invincible, the way Robert Kirkman brought that to an end, as a huge fan of the book, I myself felt the sort of like there's something missing. And it came from that trope where we just become anticipating like that final issue. There's going to be that sort of epilogue moment, the sort of reveal moment, that sort of haha, what a twist reveal kind of thing. But it very tastefully just wrapped everything. It just landed the plane gently and brought it into the dock. And I went, huh. Although I was feeling that urge, like something's missing, I had to look at it and go, no, I have to respect the fact that it didn't try to just twist something right at the end. It didn't try to just shoehorn in a, ooh, but the series might come back. Like, no, it officially said, like, if the series was to ever come back, it essentially, and spoiler alert to anyone that hasn't read Invincible yet, it essentially just sort of does a trailer, if you will, to all of those epilogues that might follow. It just went right through, like, yeah, say his daughter was to grow older and have powers. Here's a sort of homage to what that would look like. And then it just sort of covers everything. It officially just nails down every loose end to sort of say, yeah, you know what? Maybe a series followed this, but we're already going to reference that. And it, almost like a montage, just sort of flashed forward through the life and just sort of said, like, you know, and there it is. That's the end of Invincible. And I couldn't help but look at it and go, I got to commend it. In the same way, I commended Invincible for daring to do something where, as you said, with this Kree versus the Skrulls thing, with the way it's a faction of fighting that's been going on for years in the books as well as in the stories. He had that with the Viltrumites, and he had that with Earth in their attempt to try to dominate it. And I read a story where while they're fighting, they officially called a truce. And I was like, I'm officially watching a multi-issue battle come to an end by the two sides calling a truce. And I'm sitting there looking at this like, I've never seen that in a book. And if I have, I can't remember it. But if this has ever happened in another comic book, it obviously didn't stand out enough that it, you know, made big news. We always either have one side win and the other comes back, and then the other side wins and that comes back. They called a truce. In the same way, I had to commend it for trying to dare to do something different. I liked the way he ended Invincible to that same end of not following that trope of throwing that little twist on the end.
Well, to circle back around to the Kree-Skrull conflict, you said you were not a fan of it when it really got emphasized heavily in the Secret Invasion storyline. You were familiar with the Kree-Skrull before that point, though, being a Marvel reader, correct?
Right.
And you didn't have a problem with it before then? It just got too heavy-handed in that storyline? Is that what you're saying?
Too heavy-handed when it became like they're among us and they're blending in. Now we don't know which ones. And by the time the story got to that point, I was kind of turned off of reading of the issues. I was like, okay, I can't go issue by issue in the same way that I had to tap out of Game of Thrones. I'm like, I can't willingly subject myself to this kind of abuse from the writers.
That's why I won't watch this. This Is Our Life, whatever that show is on NBC, because I refuse to cry like a baby every once a week like that. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem crying, but that heavily once a week, that's too much. But to you, Seth, you're more the sci-fi guy. We always talk about that when we compare your fandom to my fandom here on the podcast. I'm kind of guessing, but correct me if I'm wrong, you were a big fan of Secret Invasion and the whole Kree-Skrull espionage aspects.
I think in the end, it was very good for what it was. I was going to actually chime in with the whole, you know, spy among us and stuff. It rubbed some people the wrong way, I think, because they had characters that supposedly, you know, Spider-Woman being one of them, had been a Skrull for like the last several years and nobody noticed. So it's kind of that, oh, everything you knew was wrong type thing, kind of like the Clone Saga, where they tried to tell you that Peter Parker actually died in the 70s and the Peter Parker we were seeing now was actually the clone, you know?
Right.
You know, that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And I think it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way with the Secret Invasion storyline.
Well, with AI and cloning being two very used tropes in sci-fi, and once again, I'm a CDU, Seth, you're more of the sci-fi guy. Don't they always run that risk when you go that way in sci-fi?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And I mean,
I think it read less as the sci-fi drama unfolding, and I think they didn't write it well enough as well with Spider-Man to come off as the sort of internal struggle, like, oh my God, how do I deal with this? And unfortunately, it came off too much as it was all a dream kind of write-off. And I think that's what really sat bad with fans was now that we just sort of threw out this excuse, and now we can just move on to the Spider-Man we want to talk about, everyone was too busy hung up holding on to their own action figures, just like, but the story we've stuck with for years is still good. Why are we just throwing this away? Because he's not the actual one. So it seemed very much like it's been all a dream, and then that just devalued everything we believed in forever.
But it worked for Dallas with Bobby Ewing, but you know, the whole season was a dream.
So we've gone from Captain Marvel to horror to tropes to Dallas and all that to Robert Kirkman. And yes, just for what it's worth, people, that the Robert Kirkman we're talking about that wrote Invincible, yes, that's the same Robert Kirkman who helped create Walking Dead.
He's not his only hit in comic books, but
right,
that's why we're here. Geekville Radio is to spread our geek knowledge to those that don't have it. So
right. Read Battle Pope. Go read Battle Pope, everyone.
But to get back on track with the story here is the story of Carol Danvers, basically, is she actually goes back to the 1960s, like we were talking about. And the character has always been connected to the Air Force. Her original role in the 1960s was she was a security officer for the Air Force, and she befriends the original Captain Marvel. And the thing about her being a pilot, which is something I welcome, by the way, and I really hope the rumors about this movie being true, and we'll get to it in the next part here after the break, but the whole thing of it being a hero story, not necessarily so much about gender. Depicting her as a pilot, I think, is that type of thing. Now, her being a pilot is something that came along in the Ultimate Universe, one of like the 17, you know, universe relaunches that Marvel's done over the last 20 years. But that still is true. It's one of the more modern takes, but most of the MCU stories are inspired by characters as they appeared in the Ultimate Universe. But to get to the gist of Carol Danvers and what makes her tick is she's essentially a hybrid of human and Kree. So that's why she has the Kree powers, but yet looks human. And in the 1970s, as Train has talked about, I think both on and off mic, quite frankly, is her run as Miss Marvel began in the 70s after she acquired these powers. And
via
she really,
an explosion, correct?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It had something to do with an accident, and she essentially absorbed energy
Marvell, wasn't powers. It Marvell's powers?
Yeah. I think that sounds right. But
so she's not a true hybrid like a Quake character, like an Inhuman. I think, you know, that probably doesn't matter to most non-comic people, but for people who didn't know that but are comic people, I think you need to realize that. She isn't one of these experiments the Kree did. She was, a la the Hulk, an accident.
Right, right. That's big there. And her main powers are, like we've said before, flight, superhuman strength. She can survive in space, which you do see in the trailers and such. And really, since the 1970s, so for the last 45 years or so, she has been very much a fixture of the Marvel Universe. I think it's only really been in the last few years that they, in my own terms, have tried to truly make an A-lister. They did that with Black Panther as well when we reviewed Black Panther. But she had always been there. And I always liked the look she had in the 90s, early 2000s as Miss Marvel, where it was a snazzy black outfit. But
the yellow lightning bolt on the front,
yes,
and the sash, yes, on her. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Now, yeah. I freely understand that a look like that probably wouldn't go over very well in a live action movie, not even getting into the whole tight black bodysuit type thing. It just doesn't look practical. You know, the suit she has in the movie, I think, looks about as practical as you could expect a space superhero suit to look. So did I miss anything as far as her powers and her looks, other than she's also been known as Warbird and Binary over time?
Right. I would say, and this is, once again, this is the world according to Crazy Train, because I am a pretty big comic book fan, I never saw and these are the three characters that I think they're trying to push as the new A-listers, are Black Panther, Doctor Strange, and Captain Marvel, a.k.a. Miss Marvel. I always saw them as major players in Marvel Universe, at least the comic book side, as I was reading these in the 80s and 90s. I can see where people probably didn't, but I also say they didn't get the love from Marvel to a Main Street audience that the other A-listers got for years leading up to that. You know, your Spider-Mans, the X-Men, stuff like that. So I can see where people who don't know comics could not see them as A-listers, and so Marvel's made a concerted effort to make those three characters specifically more important, and they're doing the MCU as the vehicle through which they're doing that. I personally, as a comic book reader, always saw those three particular characters as very powerful, very important to the Marvel Universe in print.
Yeah, I was going to basically make that comparison. Would you say that would be similarly to the way a lot of other fans were already quite aware that when the X-Men pushed Storm as well as Rogue to the front, all the other fans were like, well, yeah, like we've been seeing them for years. So like exactly. When they showed up in the movies as more predominant characters, there was no surprise. It was like, well, yeah, of course they'd take more of a lead role because Storm actually led the X-Men at certain points in the comics. So like, no surprise to us. Like,
right. I mean, she's so pivotal to the first group of X-Men and the second group, you know, and the whole Morlock story, you know, I mean, she's pivotal to that. And we're comic book readers, so we've known this for years, you know, and it's like, you're just catching up. It's like you want to look at the non-comic fans and go, dude, you're so behind. Catch up.
Right.
You know, it's like, so it's, you know, that's just me. I can, like I said, I can see how non-comic book readers would see those three characters in particular, Black Panther, Doctor Strange, and Captain Marvel, the Carol Danvers version, as, oh, they're not that important. They're just pushing it now. No, dude, they've been pushing them for years. You just haven't seen it. I mean, especially for me, I've talked about it before. Doctor Strange and Black Panther are two of my favorite superheroes. Let's look at it this way. If you want to split the Marvel Universe, both in print and in the movies, there's essentially three aspects to it. The cosmic, the earthbound, and the mystical / magical. Well, what do those three characters represent? The peak of the earthbound, the peak of the cosmic, and the peak of the mystical, right? Why wouldn't they be important?
Oh, yeah.
I think you understand where I'm going with that, don't you, Seth?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And we're talking about with those three characters, they all were created in the 60s, ladies and gentlemen. Now, granted, Carol Danvers didn't get the power set until the 70s, but that's still a long time, too. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's 30, 40 plus years.
Yeah, she could be compared to being like an Amanda Waller for Marvel.
Right, exactly. So it's like, you know, hey, welcome to the party, guys. You're only 30 years late.
Right, which is why I still kind of find it funny with a lot of the anticipation of sort of the exasperated, like, oh, finally, like, what do you mean finally, like, as if they're a strong female lead is a new thing. Like, we're still willing to support that. It just needs to be entertaining. We've been following it in the comic books. We've watched Alien. We've followed TV shows like Birds of Prey, Witchblade. You know? Right. So yeah, with this character story arc specifically, it's not as though it's a like out of left field for us comic fans. Like, no, we've seen her on the playing field for quite a while. Since 2016, I saw her really kicking off the Marvel move for one of their big summer crossover events. I saw it on one of the huge banners at C2E2. And I remembered seeing the style of the short-haired look with Captain Marvel. And I remembered actually thinking, like, oh, dang. Like, that, I actually want to pick that book up. Unfortunately, life itself with budget and finances with kids kind of got in the way, and I wasn't able to really even follow anything. And that was actually a stretch of Invincible comics I kind of fell off on for a while for that same financial reason. But it was one of those things that I never got around to actually reading, and now it's already optioned as a movie. So that to me means something. Okay, so it obviously had something to it, so I got to give it some cred, and I'm interested to see it in the first place.
Well, Seth, you want to take a break right now, and we'll come back and really jump into the whole kerfluffle over this movie on both sides?
Right, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So this is Geekville Radio, and we'll be right back.
Are you looking for a gaming-themed podcast? Then check out You Just Got Fragged. Join host Jared Aubrey and his panel of gaming enthusiasts as they discuss news and accomplishments in the gaming world, and of course, the gripe of the week. That's all at YouJustGotFragged.com, part of the Wrestling Brethren podcast family.
All right, we are back, and let me preface this part of the discussion by saying that I've always viewed Geekville Radio, both the site and the podcast and such as being kind of the place to go maybe to get away from politics, like your favorite TV show or the wrestling world or something to that effect. I've always kind of looked at that. So I do want to say that I don't think we're going to get political. We're not going to take any, you know, official political side and things. I think we just want to point out going with the controversy about the backlash or boycott or whatever you want to call it about this film, that we're not necessarily taking a specific side on that. In fact, we're probably going to show why both major sides of this are off base. So let me start it out by bringing up the main news point about this, which has been that allegedly based off stuff Brie Larson had said in interviews, that this boycott, so to speak, had surfaced about this movie, and Rotten Tomatoes, their want-to-see ratings, plummeted so much that they wound up disabling them. Now, this is not the first time Rotten Tomatoes has had a want-to-see movie aspect get bombarded. This is just the first time they actually went in and disabled it. Now, I have no problem believing that a good chunk, if not the majority, of these supposed reviews were trolls. And naturally, when something gets some steam when it comes to newsworthiness, you know, whether it's online or in this case, kind of mainstream news, that only makes the snowball roll faster and get larger. So, Trina, I'll start with you. I mean, I think I'm pretty justified in that opinion, right? That these are probably trolls and it's something that has probably gotten more out of hand based on the publicity it's gotten. Am I off base by saying that?
My opinion, I think both sides are probably not completely trolls, but I think they are some. There are obviously some trolls on both sides. I think to get on my soapbox for a little bit, I think that if you listen to the discussion the three of us just had before the break about the history of this character, Nick brought it up so well. You know, hey, welcome to the party, folks. You know, I mean, it's both sides need to slow down. And my take has always been, and I brought this up not only with this movie, but other movies. I bring it up a lot with wrestling, but I brought it up with Geek World too. Why does everyone think nowadays something has to be a statement by a entity, whether that be a movie production company, a comic book? Yes, I'm not saying that those are not there. They are. You have creative people who create things with a narrative they want to push. They're allowed to do that. That's the wonderful thing about free speech and creativity in our country. And sorry to our listeners that aren't in the United States, but most of the world has some form of free speech. It's they may be pushing a narrative, but at the end of the day, they're businessmen and women. They're out there to make money. That is why this movie was made, period. No other reason. There might be other ulterior motives, secondary and tertiary motivations behind those on the creative end. But the ultimate reason this movie was made was to make money. Now, with that being said, yes, if something is a hot button issue, you can push that narrative a little bit more simply because it will help you make more money. You know, that's true, been true all the time. But at the end of the day, we have to remember this is a business. Disney made this movie to make money. Period. The marketing campaign leading into it was to get people interested in an attempt to pay money to see it. Thus, they reap the profits. That's all. When I help train guys to wrestle, I'll ask them, what is the point of a wrestling promo? You know, the interviews, those of you who aren't wrestling fans, when you see, you know, Hulk Hogan, what you going to do, brother? That kind of stuff. What is the point of that? And I'll get a million reasons from trainees. Oh, it's to progress the storyline. It's to help the fans understand what your character is. But look, no. There's only one reason you cut a promo: money. It is to separate fans' money from their pockets to come see you. That's the only reason. That's true in movies too. Why do they do commercials? Why do they do ads? Why do they even put the movie out to begin with? To make money. I think if you keep that in the back of your mind, you might have a little bit clearer thing and thought to why anything is done. Like I said, that doesn't remove secondary, tertiary motivations or narratives from individuals or groups of individuals involved in the creative process. But ultimately, the main reason is to make money, period.
Right. And to circle back to what you're saying about it being not everything has to be a statement, it becomes a very, very sticky minefield that you're playing in if you are going to say that this is sort of a pro-female statement of a movie. If you do that, that becomes very dangerous because you're also creating the fallacy that then any Captain America movie is apparently a very pro-male movie, and that's really not it. We're trying to be entertained. We're trying to just have a good time. Look at a story. It's escapism at its finest.
Right.
When you look at the success of Iron Man, Iron Man didn't succeed because my mother-in-law and the extended families knew everything about Iron Man. No, not at all. They saw a story about a rich millionaire who also had stuff above and beyond power, beyond money. He had an iron suit. You know, so you've got this classiness of like, oh, look at me swarming and schmoozing with all these rich elites and stuff. And I'm also the superhero at the end of the day. It was escapism to classism, if you will. People could escape into this idea of being above their own class. And
right.
If we look at any kind of movie with that statement first, you lose all of the reasons why we're there in the first place. As you said, you nailed it. To make money. To be the entertained fan who separated themselves from their own money. The same reason why you cut that promo is the same reason why you knocked that Iron Man trailer out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting into that same territory where the reviews that were on Rotten Tomatoes, were they actually in response to trailers? Yes, they put trailers out. So people are bound to have an opinion. They're bound to have an opinion whether they like it or don't like it. It's not as though this came out of nowhere without any trailers present. We had a long period of time where they could have been marketing this like crazy. And it's all coming down to the wire over the last couple of months. And then a new trailer, and then a new trailer, instead of just a teaser. And now it's just these tiny little promo spots and stuff. And, you know, use this type of credit card because Miss Marvel will save the day. And you use this type of tire on your car because Miss Marvel will save the day. And I'm seeing it everywhere on YouTube ads. I'm not to name specific companies, but that's the equivalent of it.
Right.
So if they put something out to market the movie and advertise the movie, you're going to get people either interested or disinterested. Now, do I think a good majority of people posting on that that page were trolls? Chances are yes, because I know the culture. Does that devalue all of the responses? Not at all, and it shouldn't. You should take the same thing I learned in statistics the third time I took it. I wish that was a joke. Sorry, Dad. I did make it through college, but just that one class. Sorry about that. So the third time I made it through statistics, something finally stuck out regarding statistical anomalies when it comes to collecting data. No matter what, you have to compensate for approximately, worst case scenario, about 20% one way or the other because of either human intentions or human error. The moment you add a human involved, they're going to mess everything up. That's just truth. So you add the information superhighway to that mix. You add social media's ability to transfer information even faster to that mix. Mm. And you do have the grounds for increasing that 20% chance up to even nearly 50. So let's cut that in half. Let's say half of all of those negative reviews were legitimate and the other half were trolls. Trolls meaning people who just went and created a second email account just to make another negative post. People who just hopped on a forum of like-minded people and said, hey, you don't know anything about this thing, but hop on this thing and just click no. And people will do it because they're willing and sometimes to human nature.
Some men just want to see the world burn.
Exactly. There's just a willingness to be anti something. There's just a willingness to say, what's the status quo? Well, then let's, you know, spit in its eye. It doesn't matter what it is. If punk was popular right now, there'd be someone out there who would find a way to punk.
Right. I think a great example of that for me in my lifetime, to speak to what you're talking about, Nick, is the 80s sitcom Family Ties. A lot of things are generational, always have been in our world. And of course, the parents, the baby boomers, a lot of them went on to be hippies, the love and peace movement, the counterculture, you know, at that point in time, the 60s to the 80s, what we would call the left, right? So these writers, in trying to create a character that is realistic and believable, but also and infuse humor into it because it is a sitcom, they create the character of Alex P. Keaton to show that generational difference. He is the epitome of the neoconservative Reagan movement of the 80s, which is diametrically opposed to what his parents are. That was how they chose to show the generational differences sometimes in that show. That's what you're talking about, is that there's always going to be, it's just human nature, a blowback, a kickback to whatever is in vogue at that time.
Exactly. And I actually spoke recently with a friend who is huge punk. He's a bassist to a band called Umber. It's a local Or no, sorry, he's the drummer to the band. But it's a local bass and drum setup, him and his roommate from college, huge, huge rockers. But he's raising his daughter essentially in a very punk attitude. And he lamented that, saying like, oh, my God, though, the problem is she's going to reach a rebellious age. It's going to happen. What's she going to rebel against if we are the rebels?
You know? Right. Which is why, I mean, it might be a nostalgia trip at some point, family ties. That's why I loved that show. To me, it was like, they're showing a generational difference and a blowback that in a way we're used to seeing the kids rebel, the parents being the conservatives and the kids being the liberals. They flipped it and inverted it in that one, but it made sense. So it's kind of cool, you know?
Right. And in that way, it also gave opposition the platform. And I think that comes into what we're talking about here. It's really scary to just consider every possible negative review is just a troll. Because then what you're really truly trying to do is not give any platform at all to opposition. And if Stan Lee holds any merit whatsoever, when it comes to hate mail or fan mail or whatnot, people would ask him all the time, you know, how did you handle hate mail or whatever? Someone sent something through the mail. I mean, and you got to consider back in that day, if you wrote a letter to Marvel Comics to say how displeased you were, you got to understand how much time and effort that took to handwrite a letter expressing yourself, to lick the stamp, lick the envelope, put that thing in there, address to the correct location, you know, writing to and fro at those correct spots. Mm-hmm. And his response to how they responded to hate mail was he'd grab that letter and he'd go running to the bullpen. I'm like, guys, look, we got mail.
Right. I think you're speaking to something that we've touched on here on Geekville and on all of our sister podcasts. In 2019, with the advent of the internet and social media and all the platforms that are involved in that, it's truly in its infancy. We have never, ever in our society been in such an open world where there was a platform for you to speak your voice. So we're all learning about what should we say, when should we say it, what should we listen to, is what we're listening to true? This is all new for everybody. I think when I first began to realize that, Seth, I want you to speak to this too. A couple years ago, when we as wrestling fans lost Roddy Piper and the American Dream Dusty Rhodes so close together,
God rest him.
Seth brought up the point when we did our tribute shows to them on our sister podcast. This hit him harder than he thought it was going to. Mm. And you know, you talked, Seth, at then about how you didn't realize how important they were to your youth and the nostalgia. And then I pointed out, but this wouldn't have happened 20 years ago, and it's because of social media, you know, and the immediacy that has now that is in our world. It is not going away.
Basically live in an era where if you imagine yourself sleeping on a bed out in public and the rest of the world is doing this, heaven forbid you have a dream and you say something inappropriately while sleeping. The rest of the world already knows about it. The rest of the world is going to judge you by it. You're going to be held accountable to it, even if your intentions aren't there and it was merely subconscious doing it. Now, this is a weird example, but it's there because even your best intentions are being misconstrued. Even your best intentions are being misinterpreted. And I think that would be a good kind of jump off point. If you'd like, we could actually go over some of the reviews or some of the points about the reviews regarding the actual trailers. If you guys want to go over some of the points of the trailers, I know we already covered the kind of storyline, at least her origins, as well as the Skrull and the Kree. But either criticism or buffs of the trailers, you guys want to go over that stuff?
Sure. One thing I do want to add in before we go to that, and it's a humorous example, but to me, this is a perfect example of what we're talking about in some cases with trolling. There was a pretty famous image that went viral on the internet several years back, and somebody had graffitied and spray painted on a wall, "Spread anarchy." And then right below that, there's another spray painted message in a different color that says, "You don't tell me what to do." I think that's kind of fitting in what we're talking about in some sense.
Sure. I think you're right.
Choked on my spaghetti with that one.
Now, before we go on to that, I have to just flat out ask you, Seth, I don't think I've ever just directly asked you, do you feel the emotional tug at strings at your heart that you had over the death of Roddy Piper and Dusty Rhodes were due to the fact we live in this age of social media platforms and the immediacy of it?
Yeah, I think it is safe to say, because to use the wrestling example, we would see and relive so many of our memories by watching things on YouTube or on the WWE Network or something to that effect. And
right.
You're kind of more surrounded with these characters. And it's just kind of comparable to, you don't realize what a world without these people would be until, you know, you actually start living in it. But if it was something that happened, had the internet not taken off or been invented yet, and I saw it in a newspaper or magazine or something like that, yeah, it probably would not have hit me as much.
I think it, before we go on, I'm not cutting off your, I like your idea, Nick. I think a great example of that and the immediacy of things is, think about before the age of the internet, there were those key moments in history that people would ask people from a generation, where were you when you found this out? You know, for our parents, mm-hmm. where were you when Kennedy got shot? For our generation, where were you when the space shuttle blew up? For the next generation, where were you on 9/11? You know, yep. And it's because we didn't have social media. We were starting to get it around the time of 9/11, but it was very, very small. All three of those events were so big, such big newsmakers, that they were everywhere. They were on every newspaper, every television station, every radio station. You could not avoid them. So they became key moments in a generation where, through a tragedy, we were all brought together, you know, because it was so pervasive. That's kind of disappeared with social media. Everything's pervasive now. You know, it's like, there's not going to be that key moment, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure there will be, unfortunately, because it will be a tragedy, obviously. But in today's day and age, with the social media, and of course, the reaction to Captain Marvel is an example of this, everything's right there, right now. So it's hard to delineate sometimes how important something is in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, but, and I think a lot gets lost in this scramble to try to have that next big news story. So someone got cut off in traffic. This all of a sudden has to go viral on Facebook, and now everyone knows this person's name, and everyone's saying, like, oh my God, look at this horrible driver. You look at the popularity of fail videos and all that kind of stuff. You can immediately lose yourself to public subjugation just through accident, through circumstance, through situational problems that maybe if you'd look back at it, like, yeah, maybe I could have driven a little bit slower, checked my lane first, and then hit the turn signal and come out over. But it's so – and I think viral is a pretty good term for it. It is like an outbreak, informational outbreak.
Yeah, I'm such a cynic. As a parent, I always laugh at other parents when they go, well, it's just not the same world that we grew up in. There's more, you know, of all the terrible things you can think of that could happen to your child as a parent. I'm like, no. Those have always existed, and they've always existed at the levels they exist at today. You just know about them because of social media. That's
right.
And well, the counter to that is also, maybe they are right. Maybe because the people that would do these terrible things, now they also have a tool to which to network they didn't have before. So they may be
a double-edged sword.
Right. So I say all the time, either I'm the world's most, you know, optimistic pessimist or pessimistic optimist. I'm not sure which. So, well, what were some of the trailers that you had pulled out, or some of the reviews you had pulled out that you wanted to hit some keynotes on? Either one of you have any up pulled up?
Well, there's it's mainly very specific criticisms, and it's not criticisms that are, let's say, against. is that the picture there?
For the other listeners knowing, in the feed, we do this on Skype, and so Seth has now posted up the picture of Spreadarchy, Don't Tell Me What to Do, into the feed. So if you hear me and Nick laughing,
they've even crossed it out. They've even crossed out Spread Anarchy.
I'll put the picture in the show notes. Yeah.
Seth will put that picture in the show notes. If you hear us laughing, it's because we're looking up to our feed and seeing that picture.
That is true anarchy. Good job.
That's awesome. Outstanding.
So some of the negative criticisms that I've seen so far, and again, just by listing these, I'll go over what are my personal stances on them, but just by listing them doesn't necessarily mean we agree with it or that we condone it. So I'll definitely come at it in the same way I typically do. I'm an artist and I'm a writer first, and both of those goals I'm trying to entertain. And if I entertain well enough, it comes back to the other Disney goal. I'd like to make money off it. Am I making any money off of criticizing anything? No, not at all. If there's any criticisms at all about Brie Larson as an actress with the leading role of Captain Marvel, if there's any criticisms from what we've seen out of the trailer alone, I will separate past experiences from any movies. And from what I've read so far in different reviews, the worst thing that they go after is expressions. it's not to say make her smile. That's not my stance at all either. There's a lot of people out there that get really enraged by insisting a woman should smile. I never have in my life. I never walk right up to someone and tell them, hey, smile, just because they look down. To me, it's stupid. It lacks creativity, and it's I don't know, it's just stupid to me. As a creative person myself, I'd much rather be the thing they're smiling about. I'll make a joke, I'll crack a joke, I'll make a crazy face. Seth knows me in my personal life. He's, you know, he knows me well enough. I'd rather do that and elicit a smile out of somebody. And so I'm that same way when it comes to writing, or if I'm drawing, or if I'm creating something. It may not be the story that everyone wants it to be, where this is happy-go-lucky superhero. So I will grant the trailer that there's no reason for the character to smile if it doesn't fit the story. But I can understand their complaint to say there's something wrong with her expressions. In the facial expressions they keep seeing, the biggest descriptor is wooden. And I could be more specific with it as opposed to that, because there's nothing wrong with wooden. I love Clint Eastwood. His face looks like it's made of wood in certain movies. And that's what you want out of a hero. You want this chiseled, hardened, you know.
Stoic.
You know, damned English oak, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
We may want that out of a character. So if you're hearing criticisms about someone saying there's something wrong with their expressions, it could be coming from that same place where they're saying, give me something. We're thirsting for something, but we're not getting anything. Her stoicism, as they're describing it as wooden, it's more or less her stoicism comes off as just blank. She could be thinking about popcorn she left in the microwave at this moment. She could be thinking, did she feed her cat? She could be thinking, oh, that's what the explosion of Alderaan looks like.
Right.
Who knows?
Goose the Cat, I'm sure, is going to be the breakout star of this movie, by the way.
From what I've seen from other reviews, it still currently is. There's a lot of people more interested in Goose the Cat.
Well, I think I would see it on anything when it comes to acting, to what Seth says all the time. Totally agree with your points, Nick, that if you have an issue with an actor or an actress's portrayal of a role, it's probably one of two things.
Director
mm-hmm. or screenplay writer. Their job as an actor or an actress is to take words on a page and words from the mouth of directors, and then to create that through a performance. And I guess it's why I liked wrestling so much more than I wasn't a good actor, because there was a lot more improvisation and a booker just saying, hey, this is the story we want to tell. Now you two guys go out there and wrestle a match that tells that story. You see what I'm saying? And a lot was given to me, but I've been in that position as a wrestler. I didn't like the storyline, you know? And of course, as a performer, I would say, can we do this? Cause I don't know if my character would do that. And that happens on sets and movies too. You know, you'll have actresses go, I'm not, you know, that dreaded, where's my motivation? That's real though. I mean, it's like they have in their mind what they think the character should be based on their interpretation of the written word and the director. And then it becomes, that's the creative process, ladies and gentlemen. It's a compromise, really, often. But if you really want to rag on someone's performance as an actor or an actress, that's usually what it is. It's not because they're acting for the director and what the screenplay said, period. You know?
Yep. And I've seen it plenty of times where even in the trailer itself, that's a complete different take than the one you'll end up seeing in the movie. I've also seen that on set, the actor probably nailed out 5 or 6 different takes where they were just like, yes. And the director was like, okay, I'm glad you played with your range, but could you just do this weird one? And the actor was like, fine, and nailed down the weird one. And that ends up being the final take. So if I'm going to give Jason Momoa credit, that the Conan we got prior to him being Aquaman and prior to him being in Game of Thrones, if we got that Conan, it's because we got that writing and we got the direction of Marcus Nispel.
Right.
And therefore, there may be elements to that story and even in his performance that I may not be happy with. But he's the clay in that hands of that creator. And I give her that same credit. Whatever stoicism, whatever she's pulling across, it's whatever that director's feeding her. And if I'm going to give Jason Momoa that credit, I'm giving her that same credit. So that's where my stance is. I see the criticism where they're currently thirsty for more. I see the criticism of the fact that she's not emoting very well in her face. But these are also seconds out of a full film, so that we're gonna see range. I give her that credit. We're gonna see range.
I mean, she is an Academy Award winning actress, so it's not like she can't act. Let's be honest, folks.
Yeah.
And to circle back around to your analogy, Jason Momoa is good. You brought up John Carpenter earlier. All our listeners know John Carpenter is a god to me. The first Halloween movie, which of course is what kind of put his name on the map. When Donald Pleasance was hired, and we've talked before on several of our podcasts that he wasn't John Carpenter's first choice. It was like his third choice, but he's cast as Dr. Loomis. He flat out asked John Carpenter, who not only was the director of the movie, but also the screenplay writer. So he's getting kind of a package deal there, which doesn't always happen, by the way, in Hollywood. In fact, it rarely happens. Usually the screenplay writer is a different person than the director. But in this case, yep, they're one and the same. He looks at John Carpenter and says, I'll do this role for you, but you're going to have to explain to me what you want, because I totally don't get this character. And so John tries to explain, you know, a young up and coming tries to explain to this veteran award winning actor what he in his mind sees as this character. So then they proceed to start filming the movie, and John would frame a shot and start the shot and hit, you know, give his direction to Donald Pleasance. Donald Pleasance would act out what he was told by John Carpenter. And then when they would yell cut, Donald would walk over to John and go, I hope that was what you wanted, but I was thinking maybe we should do this. Can we shoot? Can we do the same scene now, John? Reshoot it and let me put. And John, of course, being a fan of Donald Pleasance, goes, yeah, let's do that too. And so they did. And John has openly said, invariably, when that scenario happened, when he got to the editing room to edit that movie together to be the final product we saw, he often went with Donald Pleasance's take, not his own take. Nice. So that happens. That happens too. That happens too. And for me, that's an example of John being young and having an idea and not realizing that his ideas are influenced by people like Donald Pleasance, and then let the guy who has the experience do his thing, you know? So yeah, when anytime you critique someone's acting, think about all these examples we're giving. You understand as an artist yourself. I understand, mm-hmm, as a former wrestler. It is a creative process that unless you have done it, it's not that I don't want to hear your critique. I do. You know, I mean, without fans, yeah, like we said, you're the ones paying the money. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do, is get your money. I'm being honest. But at the same time, I don't think you stop and realize how many things are going on behind the scenes and in our own minds as creative people to bring forth said entertainment.
Yeah.
Am I wrong in that?
You could easily even compare the original Guardians of the Galaxy trailer and just say, mm-hmm, remove the Ooga Chaka, you know,
right,
song, remove that whole thing. And you get nearly the exact exposition that you got out of the Captain Marvel trailer. You don't get a whole lot of emoting out of Star-Lord other than he flipped the finger and did that kind of joke thing. You get, right, zero to no acting chops out of Drax the Destroyer. Almost said Xandrax the Destroyer.
That's an alternate universe. Right.
Seth, yeah, wishes alternate universe right there.
Seth wishes he was Dave Bautista.
So you get zero to no emoting. I would even say Groot's performance was a little wooden. I had to get my dad joke.
Wow.
Wah, I'll show myself wah, out.
Wah.
And so that's where I'm listing it as one of the criticisms. So if we compare those trailers, just remove the energy that song brought to the original Guardians of the Galaxy trailer and just look at story delivery and character delivery, there's actually almost little to none. It really does drive the point home. Here's characters in space, a raccoon with a gun, and a walking tree. And it kind of just left it at that. And we were looking at the Captain Marvel trailer with essentially that same esteem. We're, of course, not going to spoil a story, but we're going to try to make it seem punctual. We're going to make it seem like there's drama in the same way we delivered the Iron Man trailer back in the day. It's going to try to build up this idea of escapism. Imagine having all this kind of power. Imagine being that powerful. You could go out in space, but imagine you don't know why you got it. Or imagine you do remember, but you don't know why you're here or what you should do next. You know, so it's still delivering a little bit of story. And so some of the criticisms that it delivered too much exposition. With that kind of criticism, I think, well, then to your note there, Train, it's like, well, welcome to the club. That story's been out there. This is kind of like, there shouldn't even be spoiler alerts at this point.
They're trying to get the story's been in the books. They're trying to make up for lost time for you folks. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, one of the criticisms I've seen, and it's from the other side, and you get it from both sides. Why does it matter that she's a woman? They're pushing, you know, not to get political, but they're pushing a feminist agenda. I would see two arguments on both sides, yes and no. Okay. When Carol Danvers got her powers in the comics and became Miss Marvel in 1977, they explicitly, this was in press releases that Marvel Comics put out, we named her Miss, M-S period, Marvel. to dovetail off, at that time, the current Equal Rights Amendment feminist movement. And the Carol Danvers character, when she wasn't Miss Marvel in her civilian guise, pushed for equal pay for equal work for women and men. So, yes, I brought up earlier, yes, it's to make money, but there are sometimes secondary, tertiary. This is one that was admitted long ago by Marvel itself that that was something that they were trying. That was a secondary or tertiary agenda they were pushing with this character. So those that want to get mad because they feel like it, well, yeah, but we've known that for 40 years. And my counter to that is all those who are on the other side that want to thump their chest, yay, a feminist. Well, hold on. Just like Leadbase just said, they also want to entertain us too. You know, that's why they're giving us so much exposition. Yes, this is a secondary or tertiary motive behind the character. But at the end of the day, they just want to give us a kick-ass cool story. And you just brought that point up too. So everybody just slow down for a second. You're right, but you're both wrong. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, you've each got a point, but you're almost like a step behind the meter here. The meter's kind of been rolling on for a while. So for a lot of those that are kind of thumping the chest and saying like, yay, we finally got a female, you know, lead in a movie, even if we're going down that list of like, yeah, female superhero in a movie, did they not count Wonder Woman? Did they not count Fury Road? Did they not count Ghost in the Shell? I'll even give credit to Logan because that young girl played still a main role, even though not a lot of dialogue, but she still played a main role.
Maybe Eon Flux,
Elektra, Ripley from Alien.
Alien, yeah, Ripley, heck yeah.
Kill Bill series, Tomb Raider, Terminator 2.
It all goes back to why I think our second ever show is probably the reason why it's one of our most listened to, is because we talk a lot about that. And I'm going to link that show in the show notes at Geekville Radio, and it should be in the podcaster of your choosing. But we just named several characters there that were good examples of strong female characters. We name a few more in that episode. But I guess what I can say, as far as some of the rantings that are going on, it's no fun really when you take everything deadly serious all the time. And I guess all I got to say for some of these people that seem to be angry about this, just smile for a while. Let's be jolly. Life shouldn't be so melancholy.
Now, Black Panther's Best Picture nomination aside, okay, I think all of us, even the non-comic book fans, realize that none of these movies are trying to be Gone with the Wind or Citizen Kane or Kramer versus Kramer, any of the great, you know, Oscar bait type movies that have existed throughout the history of cinema. They're popcorn movies. They're meant just to go and have fun. You know, buy your popcorn, buy your Coke, sit down in the theater and enjoy yourself. And I think that they're doing themselves a disservice by being so serious about these secondary and tertiary issues. I think that's what you're trying to say, isn't it, Seth?
Yeah, pretty much. And one thing that I also wanted to talk about, because I think we can put ourselves in the shoes, you know, the comic fans, we, the people that are supposedly spurned by this, by the narrative from one of the sides, that somehow it's like this fragile male ego thing. Well, we have been clamoring for a Black Widow movie for the better part of a decade now. As soon as Scarlett Johansson was cast as Black Widow, we thought sooner or later she was going to get her own movie, and we look forward to it. And there was no big boycott of this stature on Wonder Woman. And Alita Battle Angel, which just came out a couple weeks before this, I don't recall that happening to that movie either. And those are two examples of the strong female character-led thing that a male audience seemed to genuinely be looking forward to. And that's really the way I look at it, is you can't really blanket one side that you don't agree with these ad hominem arguments, essentially, and just putting people into one group of dislikable individuals. It's more complex than that.
I've seen that personally, Xandrax. Okay, I've been excited about this movie since they announced it years ago, you know, long before all this hullabaloo kicked on. And it was because I am a fan of the comics. I understood the importance of Carol Danvers in the Marvel comics. And it had nothing to do with the fact she was a female. It had nothing to do with the fact that it was simply the fact I've read the comics. I've read the source material. That's cool. I'd like to see a live action version of this character. At the same time, I have been in the minority who's not looking forward to a Black Widow solo movie. And I've been, so the people that want to praise for, yay, see, he's a white male who's on our side who wants to see this female character. Then they find out, oh, you don't want to see Black Widow. You're one of them. It has nothing to do with the fact Black Widow's a woman. I've read the source material, and I just, in my personal opinion, feel Black Widow is a better support character than she is a lead character. If you understand her placement in the Marvel Universe, not the movies, the comics. Those are my arguments for why I want to see Captain Marvel and don't want to see Black Widow. And it has nothing to do with their gender or anything else. It's just my desire as a comics fan for what I perceive them, me, in that universe that is the source material for the movies.
Right, but, and that to me is also kind of similar to my stance on J-Law playing Mystique. It's not an issue about her playing the character. It's the fact that as a comics fan myself, if you want a female lead that's at this pivotal role influencing characters and kind of guiding the team and whatnot, she's a bad guy, a villain. She has always been a villain. It started off in First Class where maybe she was tormented. Maybe she'll go one way or the other. But now they've kind of just cemented her in just being bad good guy. And then it just doesn't sit right with me because I'm thinking, if that's the role you wanted, why do you ever even cast Mystique in the first place? We've had so many other female leads in the X-Men that stayed that line as well. Am I good or am I bad? And you could have skated with that character. I mean, they kind of threw away White Queen. You could have used White Queen for that role, but
Storm, Rogue. God, I hate to even say it. Jubilee. I can't believe I just said that.
Shadowcat.
Deathlar. Yeah. Psylocke. There's a gazillion. You know, right. I mean, that's always been my argument against that. And then once again, I get slammed. You just don't like Jennifer Lawrence. Well, no, I don't like Jennifer Lawrence, but that's not the reason I don't like Mystique as the lead
character.
Exactly.
I may think she can't act her way out of a paper bag, but regardless, it's about why is this character here specifically? Having J-Law as that character, but keep her on the right side. That's the whole point of it. To me, it's like a philosophical argument. I want to say, was it Socrates? Or Aristotle. I think it was Aristotle, the laws of identity. The thing is the thing. A is A and B is B. And that's the whole premise as to why we tell these stories. And as you said, the tertiary reasons. There should always be a moral to the story. Of course, we got a female lead. We're going to have to address the gender because it's a great moral to push. I myself, as a father of a daughter, I want to take my daughter out to see a strong female lead and have her be entertained without it just having to be shoehorned fiction. And I've actually been trying to get her to go see Alita Battle Angel. And she's just like, eh. So if I've learned anything about women, you can't tell them what to think or what to like. Just like anyone else, you just have to let them interpret it themselves, draw their own conclusion. And so to automatically, and I guess this kind of comes to the other conclusion too many fans are critiquing it for. I've seen a lot of negative criticism regarding their pre-anticipation is where they think the story is going to go. The biggest critique and fear outside of the acting is that she's all of a sudden going to come into the overall Marvel MCU and save the day for everyone else. And there's a lot of criticism to that, saying that they're all angry. There's aspects to that I can understand, and there's aspects of that that just sound complete cattywampus and stupid. As a writer, I can understand if you look at the story or the life of Captain Marvel, printed by Marvel Comics. Yeah, Captain Marvel fights against Thanos, defeats Thanos. It's not Carol Danvers. It was the male version of Captain Marvel. So it's not that the character itself doesn't have a stance against Thanos. I'm not throwing that under the bus and saying like, oh, she doesn't have a chance. Like, no, I legit believe she is powerful enough. I legit believe she could be at the forefront of the fight holding her own, and it could be very entertaining. But what I can understand with a lot of that criticism is in the same way we've been at least hoping, if not Train's not interested in it, but if we're at least hoping that Black Widow then gets some screen time of her own because she's been in the MCU. We've seen the character develop. We're ready to be following her on a solo story. This character almost seems to have come out of the dark in the MCU. And I think the other side of the critique or the criticism is that, and not only is it coming out of the dark, but it almost seems retroactively revisionist history, I guess you could say. It seems as though, sort of going back to that Clone Saga comment, it seems like we're going back to the 90s to say, oh, she's always been more powerful and she's always been here. She's just been sitting around for whatever unexplained reason. So there's a lot of criticism on that because there's a lot of unknowns that don't sit right with people. And that's where that criticism is coming from. They're critiquing something that's still unknown, whereas I'm going to give it an open slate. I'm going to say, if these are the critiques going in, impress me. Again, I'm going to give it that open slate and say, show me the reason why this character just said, like, no, almost in Wonder Woman style, I'm going to keep myself out of the limelight. It's right. better that I just hide. Maybe it's better Thanos doesn't know she exists so that we do have this left hook out of nowhere. So right. it could be a good story point. I know there's a lot of fans critiquing it and slamming it, trying to say, like, oh, you know, out of nowhere, she didn't earn her right on the screen yet or whatever. It's not about that. It's about in any kind of fight, in any kind of conflict, you need your ace up your sleeve. And she seems as though this will be a good ace up her sleeve. Does that mean all the other players are going to be useless? No, of course not. I mean, it's the whole reason why we have our stories the way they are. I mean, they're all going to play their part and lead towards something. And hopefully it'll be to reverse and turn around what Thanos did.
Yeah, my counter to that would be, you may be right. She may come out of nowhere. I'm not speaking to you, Nick, but to those that would critique it this way. Yeah. She may be coming out of nowhere and saving the day, but is she really? Let's look at the post-credit scene of Ant-Man and the Wasp. Let's look at the trailer with Scott Lang in it. Pretty sure he's going to play an important role too, and he's a white male. So what do you say to that? Marvel filmmakers have built up enough cachet and trust in me as a viewer to allow them to tell the story they want to tell, and I'll come along for the ride. And yep. they've never really disappointed me. And I think they've done an excellent job, especially in Infinity War, but everything up to leading up to that, and there being a team concept, and that everybody's had their little moment to shine. And if you remove just one of those puzzle pieces, the whole thing, it's a house of cards. It collapses.
Yeah.
So if she happens to be the ace in that house of cards, there's still 51 other cards in that deck. They're building that house of cards. So I think people are putting too much. That's my opinion. They're putting too much into that. And I might retort to my point on to bring it back around to Jennifer Lawrence. If you want to see a Black Widow movie and we never get one, there's always Red Sparrow, which is pretty much the Black Widow origin story. But I digress.
One other thing about Black Widow that I want to mention, you know, some of the, how would you say, assumptions when I say Marvel fans have wanted to see a Black Widow movie for a while, there's kind of that blanketing statement of, oh, well, it's Scarlett Johansson in tight clothes. And I'll just say, you know, and? If you want to play the, you know, sex symbol route, how many movies has she made as Black Widow? At least six, like six, maybe seven. Has she been in her underwear in any of them? I don't think so.
I think there was one where she's in the back of the car changing and Happy Hogan's trying to get a peek. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, eyes on the road. He's like, okay. And he like straightens back out. I mean, they address it a little bit. Other than that, there is some questionability regarding the scene where Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner falls on top of her behind the bar when they all kind of, I think it was the Age of Ultron movie. Mm-hmm. So he kind of lands like right in her cleavage, and there's that awkward like, oh, friend landed in erogenous zone area kind of chuckle off the moment while avoiding acknowledging that they've been trying to build those two characters together. So I would say other than that, the closest thing would be extensive butt shots. Mm-hmm. But that happens. It doesn't matter if it's a male hero or a female hero. It just happens. Butt shots happen. It doesn't matter if it's a guy flexing his bicep or a girl showing her butt. It's going to happen one way or the other. So both sides need to kind of calm it on that concern. That's my stance on it, at least.
There is one thing, though. You're right about the whole Mark Ruffalo cleavage shot, Nick. But If you remember, when her character was first introduced, she was brought in her spy guise as a mole. We just talked about that, you know.
Yeah, one among us.
Into Stark Industries, and they had that pictures of her because she was her guy. She was a former lingerie model, so there were those pictures. They were stills that Tony was looking at of her in underwear. I don't know if y'all addressed that. My other counter to that would be
characters.
Okay, yeah. And how many times have we seen Chris Hemsworth in barely any clothes on in these movies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say two character if a secret agency like that read his profile and had him read like a book, they would know easiest way to throw something right under his nose without him smelling it, throw something female, throw something scantily clad, throw something alluring, and then of all things, because they read his personality, throw something that's giving him the cold shoulder. Boom. He cannot stop focusing on her now. You got his attention.
That's how I interpret it. This is more about Tony's character than it is hers.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, as weird as it is, I don't even see that being like her legitimate past. I could easily see that being like, yeah, S.H.I.E.L.D., we need you to do this because it works for his next, you know, for your next mark, as it were. She's like, all right. You know, she's doing it for the mark because she's a spy.
And I understand, as a pro wrestler, you know, wrestling is the one form of entertainment that has always played the lowest common denominator. We've never been politically correct. but I also understand sex sells. No matter what your sexual orientation or your gender, we all enjoy looking at good-looking people, you know? And, I mean, there's a reason why there's that scene of Captain America, you know, cutting the wood with that really, really tight shirt on in Age of Ultron.
Duh. Yeah, then he just flexes it in half.
Yeah, because Chris Evans is a good-looking dude with a nice body. Why wouldn't you show that off, right? Obviously, Scarlett Johansson is a very attractive woman. She feels comfortable wearing those tight clothes. There's nothing wrong with that. I've never understood that argument, and I agree. There is an over-sexualization and an objectification of both men and women in sexual ways in media. But it's not necessarily as bad, I think, as people try to say it is, because everybody likes to look at good looking people. You know?
To me, it seems to be less noteworthy when you know that's an actor who just got paid to do that. You're actually supporting someone making money to then do that. Now, does that justify prostitution? God, no. No. This is people making a choice to sell a product again and then choosing the intelligent business method to do it. You are not going to sell certain stories, regardless of gender, to anyone if the personality of the character is unattractive. Not the visual, but the personality. There's a reason why certain movies like The Pest find a hard audience, because
I love The Pest.
Exactly. I love The Pest. I love John Leguizamo's portrayal of it, but there are certain people out there that have no time for entertainment to entertain, say, annoying personalities. Even if it's done for the sake of comedy, it still might read to certain people as annoying, and it doesn't find its audience with them kind of people. You can't blame them. That's their personal taste. So when it comes down to, you know, sex sells, you got to admit, we want to find comfort in people who are confident. We want to find comfort in people who are attracted to themselves. That's where their happiness may stem from. That's where their confidence may stem from. They're happy with where they're at, and we tend to follow that.
And I've always argued on that point. By me saying Chris Evans is a good-looking buff dude, Chris Hemsworth is a good-looking buff dude, that, you know, Brie Larson or Scarlett Johansson are good-looking women, that's just me talking about them. That's not downplaying you, whatever you've got, good or bad, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Except let me praise those that I want to be praiseworthy. I'm not bashing those that I don't think are praiseworthy. Do you follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I get entirely what you're saying.
I just don't understand that. And then, you know, it's, believe me, as a person who had to put himself out there physically when I was wrestling, I don't have the best body in the world. Never did. That was one of my shortcomings in the wrestling world, was I didn't have Lex Luger's body. I didn't have The Rock's body. So I found other ways to entertain myself or entertain people, you know. But at the end of the day, I'm still putting myself out there as a physical specimen. Maybe my viewpoint's jaded on that one. I will openly admit that, you know?
And to that same degree, you as an actor in that moment, you have to portray that you are powerful. It doesn't matter if you've got the biceps or not. You have to portray right now you are a powerfully imposing character. That has to come off to the audience.
Right.
If you're giving a blank delivery, and this is what usually pisses off a lot of indie wrestlers, and you could probably confirm this, if you're in that ring and someone is just sloughing shots, not taking the bumps, because they're playing this really phony kind of toughness where they're almost just laughing it off.
Right.
You got to sell the bumps. Look, if you're going to win at all, you got to win something. If I'm just a fly and I can't even harm you at all, well, then you've won nothing. So they're not even helping themselves to sell the match when they just slough the bumps.
That's right. Well, and to go back to your point with the blank look on Brie Larson's face, that has been such a, you know, bugaboo to so many of these people critics. It's very possible, because like you pointed out, we haven't seen the whole movie yet. Maybe the blank expression is telling just that story. She is so powerful that these are like flies to her. You know, we don't know yet. We need to see it in context.
We might be seeing the Doc Manhattan side of her, where she's disconnected. These things are flies around me. You know, why even care one side or the other? Almost Achilles in the movie Troy. You know, why am I on this army or that army? I actually like that king better. I just happen to be born in this guy's country. That sucks, you know?
And I think that is one of the inherent – we talked earlier about social media and everybody immediately reacting instead of taking in a few days or a few moments to think about it. Everything's about context. Okay. And a lot of these reactions to me seem to be out of context. And how can they have context? The movie isn't even out yet.
Right. And all the more reason why to respond so contextually based off of contextless critiques, that to me even seems more baseless. Like, why try to silence opinions from people who haven't even had anything to garnish a good opinion on yet? Like, you haven't had them anything, just trailers. That's it. So you might as well just let them spew the hot air. That's the way I see it. To me, it shows weakness to bow to something that is so weak in itself. It's fruitless. It has no merit to it. But to have to bow to it or have to fight it or have to fend it off, then you're giving it too much credit. It's almost like in boxing, and to come back to a fighting terminology, if someone's feinting some jabs, they're not even throwing a full jab and they're just feinting it. If you do keep tucking up your guard every single time, you're actually just wearing yourself out. You can't keep flinching to that feint every single time. That feint's going to lead to that left hook, surprising left hook I talked about earlier.
Right. Well, it's the analogy you just gave with wrestling. It's so true. And you see this in acting as well. The reason why you have, real, and I'm not saying wrestling isn't real. I see myself as a professional athlete, but guys from competitive/worked environments, they often are great basketball players, football players, hockey players, whatever. They struggle in the world of pro wrestling and they struggle in the world of Hollywood, because I know from coming from a football background, your whole job in that competitive world is to not show any emotion. You don't let the other guy see you sweat. You don't let them see that hit got to you. That's part of the mental games that we play on the field, on the court, on the diamond, whatever, right?
That's the poker face, yeah. So exactly. Very much like in boxing, if I'm throwing jabs, I've thrown punches before where I'm throwing them light on purpose. I know how I already look. I already know what my punches feel like based on what I'm throwing them. I still look like I'm throwing effort, but I'm throwing tests.
And if I have a complaint as a guy who's been in real fights and then been in worked fights and then played real football, to watch a lot of fight scenes in sports movies, I'm like, oh, that's so not real.
Right.
It's like when I see an actor sometimes, I'm like, they have never been in a fight in their life, and you just cast them as a superhero who's going to have to fight, More the reason I loved the Ben Affleck take on Batman, and I've always defended that fight scene in Batman versus Superman. That's how I always envision Batman fighting, and I've been in real fights. So
you take every advantage. If there's a chunk of concrete here, I could either take a chance and ruin my armor, or I'm going to hit him with this chunk of concrete.
And because I've been in a real fight, I realize that Batman, whether you're talking movies or the comic books, it's fantasy, folks. It's not supposed to. It's escapism. It's not supposed to be 100% real, But and now you're talking about Captain Marvel, someone who has a power set well beyond Bruce Wayne's. Why are you going to think that you get my point?
Yeah, I get your point. And to kind of circle back, I'll go back to my last critique. The last critique of this trailer, it does not come from any reviews that I've read, seen so far. This is actually one of my own personal ones. It's more of a visual storytelling quirk that I tend to disapprove of. When you see the exposition shots of her flying through space and she's in like full Mohawk warrior mode and she's just sort of blasting out her beam cannons or whatever those are called. No disrespect to the character. I just don't remember the name of it, whether it's a plasma blast or something. Coming from a Gundam fandom, I see those type of space battles a lot. I follow that kind of sci-fi a lot where this stuff is very, very powerful. This is very, very powerful. And yet whenever I see a one-hit kill shot, it always kind of separates me from the believability where like, no, I want it to tarnish a little bit first. I want it to take some damage first. You clipped it, a wing blew off or something, or you fractured it and now it's floating through space, but the pilot's still kind of hunkering around in this broken ship or something. Some part of my realism wants that energy blast to be a little bit limited, because then otherwise, like I see too often in like Gundam anime, it fires off this one rocket, it hits its destination, this whole multi-million-dollar robot just explodes to pieces. And I'm thinking, well, why did they put all that money into it? If one rocket of their opposition could hit it and make it just explode like a balloon, why are we sending it up into space even? That's a lot of gas and fuel to do all that. So that was the only critique I have about that trailer. And so not knowing any of the story or context to that particular scene, that's the only part that has me concerned. Because clearly we see her on a train getting in a fist fight. So she's not exactly just, plasma blasting everything all the time. So I give the storytelling that amount of credit. But to me, that's the only concern, is that if we do eventually see her in her full BA mode and she's going all Captain Marvel and everyone, if it does come down to just one-hit kill shots, it suspends the believability for me. I start to lose it, and I kind of fall out of it. And it's not to say the whole thing's going to be bad. I'm just waving that as like a concern.
So you're obviously not opposed to all the Cobra soldiers and G.I. Joe making it to the escape, you know, parachuting out when their planes get shot down in the old cartoon. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Maybe that's where it's coming from. Maybe my childhood was sullen from that. Like, hey, they had a chance.
Yeah, I mean, how many rounds were fired in the making of A-Team, and yet no one got shot? No one.
Right. That's why I love the Toy Fair joke they made when they were doing that drunken Iron Man Mego doll and Spider-Man Mego doll stories. And there were all of a sudden a G.I. Joe episode when they had G.I. Joe's paratrooping in, and drunk Iron Man's like, ah, bats! But then once they actually hit the ground, they're running at each other, Cobra! Yo, Joe! And they're firing red and blue lasers, but Spider-Man and Iron Man are just standing there a bit bewildered, but no one's actually hitting each other because they're shooting up at like 45-degree angles. And drunk Iron Man's like, you know, if you aim down, you might actually, and as soon as he aims it down, whoa, dude, that's not how we play! Like...
This that was the reaction to it. This is the Stormtrooper school of shooting, you know? Come on.
Yeah. I'll say maybe I got it from that childhood of mine of always watching the Cobras escape with a parachute. Like, oh, thank God.
You don't realize how much of your youth that, like, reflects you as an adult, but, you know.
It's all explained now.
Yeah.
Well, Train, did you have anything you wanted to lay out on the table as we close
down
here?
I said it all at the beginning, and I'll reiterate it again. Everybody cool off. Context. Go see the movie. Go in with an open mind. And remember, at the end of the day, there might be agendas, but they're secondary and tertiary. At the end of the day, it's about making money. And period. I can tell you that as a creator myself. I tell the kids at my job, now that I work in the mental health field, I'll get questioned by some of the young boys at our facility. Why are you doing this? You don't care about me. I work because I have to. I work in this field because I choose to.
Remember
that about those that are actors and directors and others too. So,
and one other thing that I will throw in here, I did put a poll up on the Geekville Radio Facebook at Geekville Radio, basically asking people, do you plan on seeing Captain Marvel this weekend? And at last check, that poll had approximately 150 votes on it. And it was 57-43 yes, meaning almost 2/3 of the people are saying, yes, we will see it this weekend, because I thought that this weekend part was important. So it does look like, at least from our little non-scientific polling data here, that there still are a lot of people who will want to go see the movie opening weekend. And I still think it's going to do well. I mean, it may not do Infinity War type numbers, but I would be surprised if this movie is not a smash hit.
Are you going to go see it this weekend, Seth?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What about you, Nick?
Given the day of this recording, I was already going to see it this week. And the only reason why I have not yet, in which I was going to take the whole family, is because the strongest woman I know in my life, my spouse, Lindsay, this week had to go to the hospital due to a viral infection. So that's been all cleared up. She's got released just today, been able to finally come back and podcast with you guys and wrap this up. But that's the only other reason why I wasn't able to take my family this week. Otherwise, that was entirely on the docket. So, I mean, obviously, this could have been a preface going into this episode, is that we're all pretty much on board. We're all going to go see it anyway. You know, we're all interested in seeing it for our unique reasons. And I would have already seen it by now.
My plan is to go this opening weekend, and my lady friend even, you know, made a comment when Seth posted that on Facebook that her and I were going to go see it. She got a little mad when I posted, we might. I have an audit at work on Monday, so I might be working all weekend. But if time permits, we will go see it. Now, she will probably go see it regardless of whether I go or not, and she'll take her son. But I plan to go with them if I can. And I'll probably see it again next weekend when I take my own kids. So I'll probably see it twice in the opening week, just so everybody knows.
Yeah, we'll have a review as soon as any of us have all seen it then, right? You guys want to come back for that?
Sure.
Oh, definitely.
Sure.
Okay, well, we're going to wind down this part of the conversation now. Nick, I know you're going to be staying on to talk the comparison to Alita Battle Angel, but Train, I know you have to go, so Why don't we do the usual plugs if people want to talk to you about Captain Marvel or DC or wrestling or anything else? Where can they find you?
I'm always available on Twitter at crazytrade_JB. And anything that you post on our Facebook or on our website, if it relates to me or Seth feels that I will answer that question better, he'll make sure that I get it. So there you go.
Yep, absolutely. All right, we're going to take one last break here. And when we come back, Nick and I are going to dive into all things Alita Battling.
Attention all Time Lords and ladies. Geekville Radio presents Examining the Doctor, a weekly look at everybody's favorite Time Lord, the Doctor. Join Mark and Seth as they bring their signature blend of knowledge and humor to favorite and not-so-favorite episodes of Doctor Who. From Hartnell to Capaldi, Examining the Doctor provides episode commentaries for classic and current Doctor Who fans alike. Examining the Doctor, available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at geekgoalradio.com.
All right, we are back, fellow geeks and geekettes. As promised, we're going to continue a little discussion here. We mentioned it at the top of the show. Train has left the studios, and I'm now left with just Leadbase here because we're going to talk about Alita Battle Angel because it is relevant to the discussion we just had about Captain Marvel and the the strong female characters and such. Once again, if you go back to one of our earliest shows, it's actually only the second episode we ever did that we did on strong female characters, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes at geekvilleradio.com/223. So, Nick, how would you sum up Battle Angel Alita? And, you know, we hinted at it as far as talking earlier about the strong female characters. You think that this is a good example of a strong female character and something that a lot of geeks probably would like. I mean, the movie's been a pretty big hit, so it's a pretty safe bet that a lot of our geek brethren saw the movie. So, if you want to give a rundown of the movie and how you think it pertains to the previous Carol Danvers and Captain Marvel talk, the floor is yours, sir.
I would definitely say yes. This movie is a great example of a strong female lead in a movie like this, because what we're looking at in this kind of movie, and this is I'll give you kind of a spoiler-free review of it first, and then I'll go into more details later, and we'll give you a spoiler alert warning, which I'm assuming, Xandrax, you've got the alarm for that, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Good. We'll keep you guys safe. Spoiler free for now. It is a strong female lead because as a writer myself, I believe you can do one very simple thing to test whether or not it's truly the gender that makes the story move forward or whether or not it's the character that makes the story move forward. If you swapped it, that's all it takes. If you made it malleable and just said it's an android, let's say you take C-3PO and put him in that role, does that character become heroic? Does that character still, quote unquote, get the job done? And if so, then that proves that overall it's a good story. It proves overall it's an entertaining story, that it's enticing, it's gripping. So spoiler free, my review of the movie is it is an action-packed, emotionally driven, dark sci-fi thriller. And I throw dark in there on purpose because it's actually been a while. This caught me off guard. It's been a while since we've been able to watch a sci-fi movie laced with all this kind of CGI stuff where they're not just showing and throwing the CGI in your face about it. They're actually putting it in dark lighting. They're actually putting it in a mood lighting to tell the story, because for visual storytelling, that's where Alita Battle Angel, I'm used to the anime title, Alita Battle Angel succeeds in doing that because it's visually telling a story as well as narratively telling a story. And the story that it's trying to tell shows growth. It shows progress in a character, that the character itself doesn't just ascend to noteworthy success. It doesn't just ascend to accomplishing the objectives simply because the story requires it. Well, we need this character to break into this mansion. Well, how does the character break into this mansion? Well, they just have the ability to blow through the wall. Well, that was easy. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the type of character that either has to use some sort of finesse, some sort of finagling, use the right kind of charismatic talk, and they kind of Axel Foley their way into the event or something, you know? To me, even the Axel Foley skill to be able to fast talk his way through it, you see that progress throughout the Beverly Hills Cop movies, and it becomes more and more verbose and over the top and ridiculous, but it's entertainment value. It's not actually trying to do it because the whole story hinges on it. It just is sort of there. When we're looking at these type of sci-fi movies, their abilities, their powers almost, unfortunately, define the character too much. and we lose sight of the character on the inside. And you go all the way back to Frank Miller's writings with a lot of Daredevil stuff. When he takes them out of the suit, you define who the character is first, not just the suit. So to that same philosophy, it's not about the sort of power-armored cyborg suit that this girl has that defines her. It's about rediscovering who she is, rediscovering any kind of purpose. And in that way, it does call out to the everyman. Where are we in this world? What are we really? What are we here for? And we're all kind of asking ourselves that sort of purpose. We're trying to fulfill that hollow spot in ourselves every single day. And while we see this character become aware of it, we already know it going in as an audience because it's in the name of the movie. Oh, Alita, Battle Angel. Meanwhile, we start right off with that kind of footing where she has no clue. So I would say spoiler-free review of the movie. I can understand especially why it's getting so successful, because it delivers the drama. It delivers the action. It delivers fight scenes and choreography. It's not just action movie, but it also ends in a level of vulgarity that puts it back into that dark sci-fi. We don't just have villains being knocked out anymore. We don't just have villains just sort of like, oh, I'll get you next time, and then they sort of run off. Yeah, we officially get some kill shots in this movie, where as a sci-fi / horror fan myself, there was a part of me in the audience going like, ooh, like that really hurt, or oh man, that was vicious. And it's not so much vulgarity in the extent where if I, say, had my 8 or 10-year-old with me to watch it, which I did not, I viewed it first, if I would, I wouldn't feel the instinct to like, oh, cover their eyes real quick or something. Oh, look away, avert your eyes. It's aggressive enough that I could see, chances are the same parents that snuck their kids into the Deadpool movies, chances are they're the same ones that if they watch this, they thought the same way I thought. Like, oh my God, this is pretty hardcore. My kids watch Predator. My kids watch Alien. They can handle this. So it's got the right grunge to it. It's got the right heart to it that my spoiler-free review, I would say, kind of calls back to the sort of dark sci-fi fantasy we've been waiting for ever since Fifth Element. That's a huge statement to make. I'm not making it as a direct comparison, but I'd say that's a huge compliment to make, to say it puts you right back in that kind of universe where when you get dropped off in the Fifth Element, it doesn't have to beat you over the head with exposition. We get it. The technology, the flying cars, it's in the future. We get it. We can see by the wear and tear on everything, this future has been happening for a while. And you don't have to be beaten over the head with political exposition, such as like, oh, there's this mayor who runs this sci-fi town and it's extremely corrupt and we need to stop it. It's like, look, the president is Tiny Zeus Lister. We're moving on. It's like, it doesn't have to build that much exposition to like, do you get it? He's the president. Moving on. So this level of sci-fi dark fantasy, it kind of reaches out to that same nature of entertainment. I think it kind of calls for that same sort of audience. And again, that's where if you swap the gender or you neutralized it completely, the character would still stand out.
And that goes all the way back to, again, what we were talking about in that second episode, Warriors of Estrogen. That's something we agreed on, that heroic traits are heroic traits, you know, regardless of, you know, age, gender, all that good stuff. You know, if you're going to charge into a burning building to save a couple kids, that's heroic.
Exactly. And if the gender should be there at all to help define the story, I would say definitely use the gender as a support, as a backup to the ongoing heroic quest that this individual is there. In the same way we go back to Sarah Connor, her struggle that she was truly dealing with was embracing the fact that she's actually still a mother. Almost too much of her in Judgment Day consisted of being too much of a drill instructor. Like, this is what you need. This is what you need to survive. This is what you need. You need to do this. You need to do that. You get the sense in the exposition of that movie, this kid already went through that and she's locked up. And then when she gets out, she's kind of vindicated in a way. And although vindicated, she reaches a point where she herself has gone so far down that rabbit hole, she's become even less of the drill instructor and leapt over that line and became the Terminator herself, where she is a heartless, feelingless killing machine with nothing but a purpose. And she kind of realized she became the thing she feared. She became the thing she hated. And that humanitarian side, the mother side of her, in a way, brought her back. So that's where I see the gender role being of support for the ongoing character development. not necessarily that she was capable of doing it all because she was a mother, not that she was capable of doing it all because she's a woman. As the same way, it'd be a boring story if we tried saying that, well, because he's a guy, he became the Terminator. Because he's a guy, he became Mr. Action Hero. Duh. It would sound sexist if we did that. So from here forward, if you'd like, we could go into the spoiler version of my review.
Okay, I got that handy here.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler hole has been breached. Spoiler hole has been breached.
Excellent. I like that sound. So everyone's been warned. Mm-hmm. Moving forward from here, I'm going to come up with very specific plot points that will kind of reveal my stance a lot on both storytelling as a writer, screenplay, and visual storytelling as an artist. While at the same time, just all out fanboy geekery. It was great. I was geeking out a lot while watching this movie. So while watching the story unfold, for those that don't know right off of the trailers alone, we have the equivalent to this android female who gets discovered by a doctor. A doctor who, in Mad Max terms, would be considered an organic mechanic. So he manages to arrange her back together with spare parts that is revealed later on to be relative to his story arc. So to the main character, she doesn't think much about it. She has a body again. She's back up and running. He doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know who she is. He has a sense, though. Based on the technology that built her processor or whatever, he has a sense that there was some deeper purpose for her, and he may not fully know it just yet or doesn't reveal it just yet.
So he looks at her and says, oh, we can rebuild her. We have the technology.
We just don't want to spend a lot of money. And then cut to Peter Griffin running with a bucket for a leg. So the overarching environment that the story unfolds in is there is a hovering city over top of this remaining desolate wasteland city. It's very reflective to Metropolis, this idea of classism separating the elevated ones, the elites, from the lowers, the unders who do all the grunge dirty work. In this environment, there's that similar sense of it's been existing this way forever to a point where everyone tends to accept it. It just is the way it is and no one's fighting it. And you'd begin to understand why no one's fighting it, because they don't have the means to. What they do have, though, is glimmers of hope that a way out of this kind of classism, this extreme classism, they do have this little glimmer of hope that so long as we play the favored sport and we win good at favored sport, we will gain ascension. We will be able to rise out of this filth and we will gain audience with the elites up in the floating city. So there, in the background of this story, there's a sport called like rollerball. And they have like these kind of motor-powered skates and whatnot. So as she's discovering her own body, she comes across some local rollerballer players. And of course, in any typical newborn fashion for any story, first person she locks eyes on is that sort of instant love. And while we've achieved that cliche early on in the movie, you can't help but go, it happened. Whether you have Peter Parker move to a new school or not, you're going to have him come across someone. It's going to be the first person who's polite to you. And you're going to be like, I like the chutzpah of this person. I'm totally clicking with this person. It's going to happen. So I can't fault it for that. But to me, that's one of those typical checklists of like, that's a little too Disney princess for me. Like first guy she comes across, she falls in love with, like you see the eye lock and you're like, it's going to happen in the story. She's going to fall in love with this guy. And although I saw the train coming, not that train, although I saw the light at the end of the tunnel, I didn't flinch. I was like, okay, I can see where it's going. It's building up. It's just foreshadowing. That's all. The overall arc of the story begins to reveal that what she was originally designed for was a form of fighting machine, but not the body she's currently in. What gets revealed later on is that the body she's currently in was going to be the artificial body of that doctor's daughter. So therefore, you get a deeper relationship building between her and this doctor that he is, in a way, bringing her to life and nurturing her and encouraging her, almost supplementing what he lost out of his own daughter. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of father-creator kind of conflict a little bit where, you know, you're not my real father kind of thing. It does seem a bit trite or cliche when it's happening, but it's in the writing. It's in the writing that as my mind is checking off these standard check marks and these type of story plot points, I accepted it. You could hear it in the story, you could hear it in the performance, and you still care. So there's a little bit of like, you know, I'm going to do what I want at certain points in the story. And she goes off and does dangerous things that she's not supposed to, even though the dad said, don't do it. I'm telling you, we're in a dangerous world out there. And it backfires. It backfires in a manner that forces the father to change his mind. But it doesn't come off as the sort of like, you know, "Dad, you're just stingy and doing it the old way. You need to see my new way." And then, of course, the cliche, like, "All right, daughter, you've impressed me. I'll totally change my way of thinking." Instead, you understand why he changes his stance, because out of her safety, eventually her body is destroyed. Her processor, her main heart, her main head, everything is still alive, but her body is mangled. And there's no other way of keeping her alive but to retransplant her again into the same alien tech that her, the rest of her core is designed out of. And so basically giving her the original alien tech body that was supposed to go with her. So now she's fully armored, fully upgraded, full agility, full skills and everything. But you then understand why he did it, because he's doing it for her safety. Like, look, if anyone can handle this tech, it would be you.
So she's like, "You have not yet seen me in my final form."
Exactly. And then, according to Pokemon standards, she went shiny. So in a way, you do see the evolution of the character, that she's not just being hand-fed success through the film, as she's coming across these sort of hunter-killer type characters, which, for whatever reason, we can't call them hunter-killers, so they call them hunter-assassins. As she keeps coming, because it's so different, you know, as she keeps coming across them, and as the overall plot is unveiled that someone's coming after her, someone's trying to stop her, she's trying to get to the top, eventually she realizes her true destiny. It's so well pushed in the background that you enjoy as an audience, almost like a Shakespearean aside. You see her true destiny while she's completely oblivious to it. You know what she's doomed to eventually become. You know she's about to become essentially the Robin Hood, and she's not aware of it. So what I like most about the way it's delayed in the story is it's not delayed out of abstinence, like, you know, "Follow your true destiny." "No, I don't want to, because I want to live my own way. I don't want my body to define me." It's thankfully not that cliche or trite. Thankfully, it's more of an oblivious thing. It's more of a doomed fate where you are bound to eventually do it. You know the route she's bound to be taken down, this emotional struggle. And as she's becoming more aware of it, you're seeing her taking those strides, rising to the occasion, as opposed to just throwing it on like a jacket and then just powerhouse punching through everybody, which to me falls back into that Mary Sue category, which tends to devalue the character. If you look at someone, say like Shazam, you give superpowers to a teenager all of a sudden, Mary Sue. So it's not, and I forget, there is actually a term for the guys too. I'm not just throwing it out there, but there is a term for the guys. I forget what that one's called. But it's that same idea, an overpowered character that didn't work to earn the power or earn the characterization. So after she's risen to the point of actually having this battle-hardened bodysuit, after she's risen to the heights of being really good at this rollerball game, after the love interest whom she was falling in love with is the doomed star-crossed lovers reveal, boom, he's actually kind of shady on the side and she didn't know about it. He, too, is also in a character arc. So he's not just so stapled down like you see a lot of other female lead movies do, where, oh, the other guy is just like one-dimensionally bad. You see the fact that even he is struggling. He has compassion. He's learning to open himself in this hardened environment that makes you close yourself off to other people. You see him evolving. And it, in sort of that Shakespearean tragedy fashion, he opens up a little bit almost too late in the story and makes the change for the good, and unfortunately suffers the cost for it, which is that exact compelling thing that thrusts the character forward into the story. I heard a couple of good independent comic writers who kind of at C2E2, I want to say last year, they described story writing in the same fashion that this movie played out. And it hit me then as a writer. Oh my God, that's what truly makes these stories good, or it makes them bad. They are comic creators Comfort and Adam, and they're out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Check them out if you get a chance. Comfort and Adam did a presentation talking about good story writing takes place with simple words such as "because this, then that." That usually can describe some of the best movies. Otherwise, it just seems like a random string of events that just forces a character through there. Alita Battle Angel follows that same string of logic where because this happens, then that. Because this happens, then that. And so because of all of these events that keep evolving and changing and morphing the story, it rises to the occasion. And as I said, you take a step back as the audience, you're already able to predict it. And that's what makes it great, that the character doesn't know what she's destined for yet. You're seeing the fact that she's destined for something bigger. And you, the audience, have already kind of clicked and already put it together, and you're excited for her to reach that point. But as an audience, you're not spoiled. She doesn't just put the jacket on and then just go punch things in the face. So I really enjoyed the climax of the film where she's at her peak. She's suffered her loss. She finally has assimilated with what her true purpose is. And I know this might have upset a few audiences to end the movie this way, but spoiler alert again, the ending of the movie leads into a sequel by the fact that she's at the top of the rollerball game and about to ascend to the upper deck as a champion. She's about to accept that invite up to the top. You get the big reveal of what could only be described as sort of the all-father, the guy who's been pulling the strings the whole time, the puppeteer to a lot of it. You get the reveal that he's up there kind of smiling down on her while she has that warrior look on her face that she knows what she's bound to do, and it goes to credits. And it leaves you at that so that you know there's more springboard off of this. It doesn't just end because she finds her purpose and then accomplishes it. It doesn't just wrap up all in one movie. And that's what I feel is really good about this too. It doesn't just spoil the audience by just handing you every piece you want and a good female lead. Here, you know, she gets powers and then she's super strong, has a love interest, knows who the bad guy is, and then stops the bad guy. Well, that's like playing a game of cards and you just handed me all the aces. Well, then the game's over. I didn't want that. I didn't want you to just pick them out of the deck and go, here you go, here's all four aces. Hey, look, you won. Or here you go, here's a straight flush. Here you go, here's a royal flush. Yay. So what I enjoyed most about that movie was that I was surprised again to be able to watch a movie without knowing the lead actress, her name, or past work that she's been, without knowing the name of the director until afterwards, and that hit me in the face. I'm like, come on, I'm a huge Robert Rodriguez fan.
Yeah, and you didn't notice this? Yeah.
You know, I'm not even paying attention to the credits. That's how much I just disconnect when I go into a movie and I let myself cut off from, you know, previous information, and I say, okay, show me. You know, bring to me what you're going to entertain me with. That doesn't mean I went into it negatively. Doesn't mean I went into it positively. I went into it objectively. And I was able to walk away saying, I've written off in my head all these different check marks for what would be typically a little too femme strong of a story plot point. There's these two cliched moments that just keep happening throughout the story. I was able to collect this checklist in my head and even still, while doing so, say, but I'm okay with it because it works. It makes sense to the story. It springboards forward. It evolves the plot. It develops the character. It doesn't overfocus on the gender. It doesn't overfocus on just the suit being everything, just her abilities being everything. So I couldn't help but walk away from it saying, wow, wow. I was really happy to be impressed.
Well, it is worth mentioning for those that may not know about the books that the movie is based on. There are actually, I believe, 8 books in the series, and this film covered mostly the first 4. So it's pretty safe to say if they do greenlight a sequel that they'll probably just follow the other books. I don't know if it's made truly enough to warrant a sequel. It did make $350 million worldwide, of which, as of this recording, March 4th in the year of our Lord, 2019, it only made about $80 million in the States, but we now live in a world where, worldwide gross is looked at with a larger scope than just simply American releases. A perfect example of that being the animated movie The Adventures of Tintin, because domestic gross for that movie was only about $80 million, and that was off of a budget of, I think it was over 100. It was a pretty expensive for a mostly animated film.
Eesh.
But it went and grossed almost $300 million in foreign markets alone. So together, you know, that's like $380. So that's on a similar budget, but they announced a while back that there will be a sequel because it was successful worldwide. So it's possible it might warrant a sequel. I don't know. It sounds like if they are going to do a sequel, that kind of the best is yet to come. I mean, is that worth saying, do you think?
I would say so, yeah. Because you could also analyze the material itself and the following that's already subject to The Adventures of Tintin. As a comic artist and writer myself, Tintin's one of those that flew under the radar of me for so long. I didn't know about it until I was teaching a comic illustration class. And one of the kids in the class, even while I'm trying to say, like, oh, we're going to design characters today. Let's work on designing characters. Let's go around the room and you pick a trait and you pick a trait and we'll kind of like build a character together. this kid kept describing Tintin every single time. Even on a day when we were saying, like, okay, design your own character today. He was like, like a boy adventurer who has like a pet dog. I'm like, is it Tintin? No, no, no. But he's got like a really cool hairstyle where like it stands up. I'm like, is it Tintin? So I was unaware of the lineage that goes with that character and how far back it went. So I started digging into like, why does this kid like this character so much? I started looking into the movie and looking into the comics and the history and the past of it. And I was blown away. Wow. But by being able to analyze it in that way, I can understand why the American market technically flopped in that way, that it did nearly one third of what the rest of the world did for sales. Should still look pretty good, but you'd got to understand that the American market is a consumer's market. We should practically be doing half of what the rest of the world's putting out, so not just one third. And I could see why a lot of studios might be using the American numbers specifically to determine the success, because worldwide people might just take it because it's a big name. It might be the only things that are in their smaller theaters, as opposed to, let's say, smaller independent Hollywood movies may not have such a worldwide distribution. They may not get that big of a distribution deal. So certain theaters worldwide may only play big ones, like, say, even Atomic Blonde may not have played in certain theaters around the world, you know, for all we know. But bigger stuff like Tintin might have had a more global distribution to theaters for the sake of sales. And yet, something about its audience in the U.S. obviously didn't jump on board that heavily with both feet. So we could look at that kind of material too and go into a comparison, say, with like Captain Marvel or even like Alita Battle Angel. And you could say the anime, the manga, they both had a huge following. And one could analyze the numbers in the U.S. and still wonder, well, gee, well, then why did it not have a big turnout? You still also have to understand the culture of that type of fandom too. Some of our fans, as you and I both know, we're curmudgeons in a way. We like the original. We like it as it is. And anytime there is a new revamp, you're going to get a bit of separatism between the fans. You're going to get some who will embrace change. They'll enjoy the idea of experimenting with the character. And you'll get some who will treat film as though it's a documentary of truth, as though it is reality itself to their character. So if it's finally going to show up on film, they've already got reality printed in their brain, and that's the comparison that it needs to match. And those tend to be the hardest fans to have to impress, because we can all still interpret, even from the written word, a complete different translation, let alone from the manga artwork to the anime itself and the vocal performances from the Japanese performers to the dubbed English versions. You're going to get a different performance each time. And you will get some of the purists that will say, no, I only like it this way. I only like it with the Japanese voices. I only like it with the original, you know, Japanese cast. So I could say it's a fair assessment to look at the success of Tintin and say, yeah, worldwide it did great numbers. U.S., it may not have done amazing. Will that increase the chance of getting a sequel, just the fact it did global good? Probably not. And that's unfortunate, because I do think they will gauge the success of the American market as like whether or not they're going to stay faithful fans. If they didn't do good enough numbers, then they didn't tell enough friends, not enough spoken word, didn't get enough butts in the seats, didn't sell enough popcorn in the theaters, as Kevin Smith put it.
And on that note, this brings us to the end of this edition of Geekville Radio. Want to thank Train for joining us in the first half there. And Nick, if there's any way people want to look you up on the interwebs or through social media or read your comics or anything like that, the floor is yours now for any plugs you want to have.
Certainly. Coming up this year, C2E2 2019 on Saturday, I will be at the Heroes Initiative booth signing copies of a Hero Initiative comic that we are putting out with a couple of local Chicago artists who we've known from 24-Hour Comic Day through Graham Crackers Comics, local comics chains. Amazing, great guys, great gals that work there. Awesome crew, very supportive of the fandom. It's the closest I can compare to old school comic shops, where when you walk in, if you strike up a conversation, it's like an old school comic shop where you could actually sit there and banter like modern people do on forums or like us on podcasts. Yeah. So
absolutely. I can vouch for that, because one of the first Graham Crackers comics was in my town, right behind a bowling alley. And that was where I first fell in love with superheroes. You know, I mean, I'd watched, you know, Super Friends and such, and I'd started to read comics more like G.I. Joe and Transformers. But, you know, that was that type of thing. Even now today, while it's in another area of town, it's like you can still walk in, and assuming they're obviously not already helping customers, you can talk to the people behind the counter or obviously the other customers or something like that, and make all the references you want. Everybody gets it, you know, laughs or chuckles or whatever. So I can definitely relate. But anyway, I didn't mean to talk over you, so.
No, that's all right. Yeah, total plug right there for Graham Crackers Comics. Some of the old school crew from the Plainfield location. We got Doc and Bob. They put together this 24-hour comic crew. We've been doing the comics challenge every single year, and they got us published a year ago. And we've decided to do another book for this year. And again, the Hero Initiative book raises all kinds of funds for Golden Age comic artists, Silver Age comic artists, artists in the past who were never given creative license rights, perpetuity rights, and that kind of stuff. They never had health insurance. They didn't have these huge contract deals people have with modern comics. So they're getting up there in age and they're needing help in all different fronts. So the Hero Initiative divvies that money out to the people who truly need it, that have kept this industry alive on the page and in our minds and in our imaginations for so many years. So I don't mind, and these other artists, they don't mind. We've put in a little bit of time. We've put together a cool little book. It would be great to see people out there pick up the book. All the money goes towards the proceeds. Again, it does not go to us. We donated all of our time and our effort. But if you'd like to look us up, again, Hero Initiative. Otherwise, you can see my work at Lead Base Studios on Facebook. I've also got a DeviantArt page, but I haven't been on it for years. So pretty much just dwindled down to just my Facebook page. There is no dash anymore. It used to be Lead-Base Studios, but now it's just Lead Base Studios, B-A-S-E, Lead Base.
And, of course, you can find us at geekvilleradio.com. We have a Facebook comment section there on the website, as well as our Facebook, Geekville Radio, as well as Twitter, Geekville Radio. Drop us a line if there's anything you want to hear or you want to give us some feedback. You know, that's my personal feedback. Anyway.
I thought that was your fax machine. or your dot matrix printer in the background.
Yeah. As I like to say, I even welcome negative feedback as long as it's genuine. Just be honest with what you say. We are on Apple Podcasts and at iTunes. You can find pretty much the entire family of Geekville Radio shows just by doing a search for Geekville Radio on the podcast catcher of your choice. But we do have subscription pages at Geekville Radio for each of the shows. Each of the shows is going to have its own page, and we'll give you the how-tos on looking up episodes and subscribing from there. So give us a follow and give us a rating as well. You know, like I said about feedback, and give us a rating. So with that said, we're going to shut down the power here in the Geekville Radio studios. And I'm going to go underground because there's no air conditioning and it gets really cold in March. And we will talk to you folks again next time. Geekville Radio is not sponsored or endorsed by any products or services unless specifically stated. The views expressed by the hosts and or guests do not reflect the views of GeekvilleRadio.com, the Wrestling Brethren podcast, family, or any of their affiliates. Some media used in Geekville Radio is the product of their respective copyright holders, all rights reserved.
Well, if you're not gay, did you happen to bang any of those sexy Avenger chicks when you were a member? Wasp, Moondragon, Scarlet Witch?
I had a fling with Captain Marvel.
Probably the first one, you queer.